January 5th, 1990, and Gloria and Steve Haig and Grace Mullen, acting librarian of Westminster Seminary, Jim Pakula, are here interviewing Dr. Alan A. McRae at his office at approximately 10:45 a.m. Dr. McRae, as you know, Ms. Mullen is very interested in much of the history that you've shared, and particularly in one Charlie Woodbridge, whom you've referred to from time to time. And so without further ado, I will turn the session over to you, and at any point, Grace may want to ask for a clarification or an elaboration or whatever. There are other questions perhaps a little later in the session.
Well, I will go back now to 1924. And as I think of that year, so many memories crowd in on me that it's hard to know which to select for sure. But since we're today centering on Charlie Woodbridge, I will begin with my arrival at Princeton Seminary in the fall of that year. Now, at Princeton at that time, they had four eating clubs. And eating clubs, new students would take turns in the different clubs during the first week or two in order to get acquainted with the members of the club. And then the clubs would vote on which the students they wanted, and they had a rather complicated system of arranging it so that the student had a certain voice regarding the clubs, and the clubs had a slightly greater voice regarding which students they wanted. So I rubbed shoulders with a good many new students in the course of these shifting around during that first week or two. And I remember particularly meeting at that time a young man from Grand Rapids named Ned Stonehouse, and a young man who had just arrived shortly before, I believe, from China, where his parents had been missionaries. His name was Charles Jaleel Woodbridge. As I spoke with him, I should mention the fact that before I came to Princeton, during the summer before, I had come across a new book published by Dr. Machen, Christianity and Liberalism. And when I began to read it, I was so interested that I could hardly lay it down. But I was much interested in meeting Dr. Machen when I got there. And, of course, I, having graduated from a so-called Christian college where unbelief was being mixed in with the teaching at just about every point, I was greatly thrilled to read the clear presentation that Dr. Machen gave of the great problem of our day. Well, I remember speaking to this young man who had just arrived from China, and he mentioned how he had come on the boat. I think he'd been a month on the boat, and what fine time he'd had with a leader in the mission organization of the Southern Presbyterian Church. And I forget the name of the man, but I had happened to hear questions about his loyalty to the Word of God just before. And I raised some question with Charlie, and he seemed at that time not to have any idea what I was speaking of, which made me think that he did not have a realization, as I did, of the coming in of liberalism, as Dr. Machen called it, though most people at that time called it modernism. Well, these clubs took their vote, and Charlie joined the Benham Club. I joined the Friars Club. The Friars Club had a large group from the University of Pennsylvania and a large group from Occidental College who had come all the way across the country to attend Princeton Seminary. The Benham Club was the oldest of the eating clubs, and it was different from the others in that it was practically a fraternity. When Dr. Machen was under great attack shortly before Westminster Seminary was founded, I was told that leaders of the attack against him were largely men who had belonged to the Benham Club, but that they could not find anyone of their friends who was willing to publicly attack him because he had been a member of the Benham Club. Eventually they found someone who hadn't been a member who would lead the attack. But there was this sort of a fraternity spirit in that club. And one of my friends, before he came to Princeton, was told by the president of our college, oh, he said, I'll give you a letter to introduce you to the Benham Club. He says, you can't get a decent church if you're not a member of the Benham Club. Well, this friend of mine didn't have much use for that particular college president and didn't ask him for the letter, but it gives an idea of the attitude of the Benham Club. Well, it was no surprise to any of us that the Benham Club invited Charlie to join it, because Charlie is one of the two men I've known in my life who had more charisma than any others that I have ever met. And Charlie just exuded charisma. I wasn't so aware of that at first, but about a week after school started, they had a meeting of the junior class at which the president of the student body presided and asked them to elect a president. And immediately, Charlie Woodbridge was elected president of the class by acclamation. And Charlie soon became rather unpopular in the Benham Club, I understand. I think that he had a real loyalty to the Word of God, though he did not realize the situation in America, and therefore was less suspicious of people, opponents of the faith, than I was with the experience I'd had. The leaders of the Benham Club included many who were strongly in favor of the modernist group, or at least of those who seemed to be professional ministers, who considered it as a position and a chance for a leadership of some sort, but not particularly interested in religiously. And I got the impression from things I heard that many of them did not care much for Charlie. Yet, when it came toward the end of the second year there, and they had to elect the president of the club for the next year, they unanimously elected Charlie president of the club. And the story was that he would make such a fine front man for the club that he would attract the people that they would like to have in the Benham Club. Well, Charlie seemed, as I look back on it, during his time there, gradually to become more and more aware of Dr. Machen's stand and of Dr. Machen in general, and to take an attitude of strongly supporting Dr. Machen in all that occurred. And, of course, that did not help to make him popular in the Benham Club. I saw him from time to time during those 3 years. He was always very friendly, but I got to know him much better later on. At the end of the 3 years, there were certain scholarships available for travel abroad. And, I should mention before I get to that the latter part of the second year, one of the students, members of our class, named Ed Ryan, who I think will be familiar to people for his book on the Presbyterian conflict and for a number of other reasons, Ed Ryan took the initiative in organizing a group of students whom he personally selected to have a meeting once a month in which one would give a paper and they would discuss it. And Ed was a man of considerable initiative in such regards. Now, Ed Ryan got a scholarship to study abroad, and Charlie Woodbridge got one, and Dr. Robert Dick Wilson, with whom I worked very closely during the time there, got a special one for me from the president of the American Bible Society at the time, who was going to give this money, I understand, to support Dr. Oswald Ellis's activities and studies, but Dr. Wilson persuaded him instead to use it to send a man to do advanced study in Germany. The particular fellowship that Dr. Wilson had the giving of moved between his department and another year by year, and in this particular year it wasn't his department. And when I had spoken to him about writing for one of the other fellowships, he urged me not to because I wanted to work closely with him. And he said, just trust the Lord and you will find it, things will work out. And then he got this group to give this this man to give this fellowship to me. Well, I went over to Germany early in the summer and learned something of German ways and customs, and got a good start in the German language. And then one day I ran onto two fellows who looked almost as if they were lost. They didn't know where to go to eat. They weren't at all familiar with the customs. They had just arrived from America. And they were Charlie Woodbridge and Ed Ryan. So I took them to a place that I had learned by that time was a pretty good place to eat. And we sat there and ate. And then after we finished eating, I remember that they immediately jumped up and were about to go. And I said, where are you going? And, oh, they said, we finished the meal. We better get going. Well, I said, well, what's your plan here? Well, they weren't accustomed to the more relaxed German system, which I had become well accustomed to by that time. So they sat down and we continued to visit. Well, and I introduced them to some extent to what I had learned during the previous couple of months. Well, I was over there, I stayed over there for 2 years. And then I taught for 2 years and went over again in the summer. And it's rather interesting that each of the times I returned, one of the two men with tremendous amounts of charisma that I mentioned saw me off as I got on the boat. Charlie Woodbridge being the one who did for my second year in Germany. Well, over there, during that year, I was asked to preach in the American school, American church in Nollendorfplatz, church which I had attended a good bit. And I was invited to do this and to live in the building. Well, I really had an apartment. And the man who had been preaching there, who was going to teach at Union Seminary in Virginia, left in the middle of the year. So they invited me to preach there the rest of the year. But I told them I had come over to study, and I didn't feel that I would be right to take on a full-time pastoral job along with it. But I said, if you'll get someone else to preach half the time, I'll be glad to preach the other half. Well, they invited a young man who was a graduate of McCormick Seminary. And in Chicago. And as I learned later, this man had gone to a Presbyterian college as a very thoroughly devoted to the Word of God, absolutely believing in everything in the Word of God. And during his college course, he had been assaulted by modernistic teachings and resisted them, but it had affected him. Gradually, he had changed during 4 years there. And then he had gone to McCormick for 3 years, and he had gradually moved there. So the result was that he greatly loved the church. He loved the church, was just devoted to it. But his belief in almost anything was pretty well gone, as far as I could see. Well, Mr. Strahl was his name, and he moved in and lived in the apartment there in the building, and he would preach one Sunday and I would take up the collection. I would preach the Sunday and he would take up the collection, and I would preach on the deity of Christ and on the resurrection and its meaning for us, and he would sit in the front row and his face looked as if he was in utter misery. I don't know whether mine looked as bad when I sat there, and he preached on the glory of the commonplace, or how when Jacob went down the hill and across the Jordan, he left the territory of Yahweh and went into the territory of a different god. So, but one Sunday night, Strahl and I were having a cup of coffee together, and I said to him, you know, I said, this morning, in your prayer, it sounded as if you believed in the deity of Christ. I said, I was quite surprised. Oh, he said, I have no difficulty with the deity of Christ. Well, I said, you don't? Well, I said, what do you mean by deity? What do you mean by God? Oh, he said, God is a symbol for ethical value. Well, I said, how can you pray to God then? Oh, he says, you can address a stick or stone. You can talk to the ocean. Well, when I preached, I was praying to God, And when he preached, he was addressing a stick or a stone or speaking to ethical values, what the people like both of us. And Charlie talked to this man, and Strahl told me one day, he says, I'm wondering, with all the training I've had for the ministry, whether I perhaps will not be able to make a career of it as I expected. I said, why is that? Well, he says, Charlie Woodbridge talked to me how it was my duty not to preach, believing as I do, my duty to leave the church. So I was pleased at that evidence of Charlie's out and out stand. Now, Charlie had, in addition to his scholarship from Princeton, he had gotten an exchange scholarship, which gave him a little added money, but also gave him certain particular advantages, one of which was that he was to live in a German seminary student home, which was quite some distance away from the university. And he moved in there with these students. And very soon after after school started, one of these students said to Charlie, he said, tonight I'm going to Professor von Harnack's lecture, his first meeting of his seminar. He said, why don't you come along with me? Charlie said, oh, would I be welcome? Could I do that? Don't you have to make arrangements ahead? Oh, no, he says, come along, that's all right. So Charlie went along with him. And Professor von Harnack said after they had the meeting and discussion, he said, well, now we have 20 men here and 20 is the size of the seminar. So he says, we will consider that you men will be the seminar for this semester. And we found out later that Ed Ryan had asked Dr. Machen and maybe one or two others, I'm not sure, to write letters to Professor von Harnack about him and asking as a special favor to them that Professor von Harnack be permitted to, Mr. Ryan be permitted to be a member of his seminar. Well, Ed waited for an answer, and two or three days after the first meeting, he got a letter from Professor von Harnack, which said that the seminar was already filled. The total number was filled, and he was sorry there was no empty place which he could put him in the seminar, which I thought was rather ironic that the one who worked so hard for it couldn't get it, and Charlie got it so easily as that. Charlie had many interesting experiences there among the German students, which gave him an awareness of the difference in general outlook that we had, and he used to tell me about some of it. Charlie and I had some very good times together of talking and comparing our experiences during those years, but at other times he seemed very, very busy. He was trying to learn German well, and with his fine musical ability, he could catch on to the sounds far better than I could. And I worked very hard on it during 2 years and a half. Well, he may have made as much progress in 1 year as I did in 2.5, I don't know. But with his good musical ear, he got it very, very well. But he worked very hard, and there were times when I would be walking along the street and see Charlie. All of a sudden, he would show up coming my direction, and I would think, my, it's nice to see Charlie again. And as he approached me, he said, greetings, Alan, how are you? And before I could answer, he was past me going on down the street. One time he asked me to go with him to a service in the cathedral. And we lived in different parts of town, so we agreed to meet at a certain place where there was a big subway station. And there were three levels of the station. And we were to meet at a certain time. And I got there shortly before the time. And I looked around for him and didn't see him. I went down to the next level down. I didn't see him. I went down to the third level. And there Charlie was pacing back and forth thinking of something. And I looked down into the place which was all open where the cars should come. And there were no tracks there. They didn't have any tracks on the lower level yet. And he'd been there for half an hour walking back and forth pondering something. We went upstairs, and fortunately, just 4 minutes later, the train came to go where we wanted to go. So we went to the German church together that day. Charlie and I made a couple of trips in the mountains in the snow there together, over in the mountains of Silesia. And we had some very good times, though they were very quickly over, because the second semester, he and I think Ed Ryan, too, though I'm not so sure of that, left Berlin and went to the University of Marburg. It was all often a custom to go to various universities. I go to one for a while and switch around. But I found everything I wanted in the University of Berlin, so I stayed there entirely. But these two fellows went, I know Charlie did, to one semester in Berlin and one semester in this other place. Well, now I think that I'd better take a look. As I think of the about Charlie, I remember recollection crowded in on me. It's hard to know which to take time for. But I think again of an experience during the time we were at Princeton Seminary, when it seems that some of the faculty women used to have a tea now and then on a certain day, and it was announced they would be at home. And one time when he and I went to one of these teas, there was a guest there, the sister of the novelist Booth Tarkington. And this woman said, she gave a sentence, I forget the sentence, but she said, if you will pronounce this sentence, I will tell you what state you come from. And one after another pronounced the sentence, and she said what state they came from. I said it, and she said, oh, you were brought up in Michigan. Well, Charlie said it, and she was puzzled. She says, you know, she says, I kind of think you're from North Carolina. And then I think you're from New Jersey. And she says, that's strange. Person would, you don't know which of the two it is. And it's a very unusual combination. Well, he said, I was brought up in China. But my father was from New Jersey and my mother was from North Carolina. So that was interesting, showing something of his background. Well, I received word I wanted to spend a third year abroad, but I got word from Dr. Wilson and Dr. Ellis. They were very anxious that I come to teach at the first year. So I packed up and came over to the start of the new seminary. And the next 3 years were, I think, among the very happiest years of my life. Oh, there was a spirit, a unitedness of spirit. And the student body, it was a wonderful student body. People who had gone to this new seminary that was unknown as yet because they wanted a strong stand for the Word of God. And there was a marvelous spirit. And they were very wonderful years. The second year, another fellow I'd known at Princeton Seminary, another member of our class, came to join the teaching faculty, John Murray. And Murray just loved to get to a student prayer meeting to hear the students pray. They had such a marvelous spirit. Now, Dr. Machen was just possessed with the realization of the way the churches were going in America. And he was very anxious to build a seminary that would have an influence. But I think even more, he was determined to raise a standard in the church, a standard to which people could rally for the Word of God. And so he was teaching and doing excellent teaching, and then he presided in the faculty meetings every Saturday. But he traveled a great deal and was speaking here and there and trying to raise the issues against modernism all the time. And I saw, as at first it was a little hard to get to find churches for the graduates because the seminary was quite unknown as yet. But within 2 or 3 years, it was becoming easier and easier. People would get a candidate from some other seminary and they would hear perhaps a nice polished discourse, but they would get one of our students and he was on fire for the Word of God. And he really knew the Lord. And so the students soon were getting good, very good churches. And if the school had gone on the way it was for, say, well, for 20 years, I think, at least within 30, the great many of the best pulpits, the most influential pulpits in America, would doubtless have graduates of the seminary in it. They could just see the difference in the graduates, and they really believed something, and they were well-trained and able in presenting and expressing it. And most of them, of course, came from a very fine Christian backgrounds, and they were just filled with zeal for the Lord. But I had something of a shock during the first year when a student came who had been in, who was pastor of a church down on the Jersey Shore. And he was a very fine evangelist. And he was coming up every week for one day to hear, to attend a course by R.B. Kuyper in, I forget whether it's called doctrinal preaching, something like that. And in this, he said to me one day, this fellow Atkins said, you know, he says, I'm getting rather puzzled, he says. He says, I've been saying, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and thou shalt be saved. And I can't say that anymore, he said. He says, Dr. Kuyper says, you can't say that. You can't tell people to believe on the Lord. And I says, well, why not? Well, he says, I says, what should you do? Well, he says, you just have to try to get them closed in to where they see nothing they can do, and then the Lord can come in and save them. Well, it didn't sound very sensible to me, and so I wasn't too displeased when at the end of the year, Dr. Kuyper accepted the presidency of Calvin College and wasn't back the next year. But the teaching, of course, took a great part of my attention during the years I was there, but I was aware of what was happening. The events in the school took most of my time, but Dr. Machen would come in and give these wonderful courses, and then he would disappear because he was speaking all over the country and writing and doing his best to promote the cause. Well, after I think 3 years, Dr. Kuyper came back. And they got a letter from somebody, and a minister wrote, and he said, I hear that you teach the limited atonement at Westminster. He said, now he says, I would like to recommend the seminary and send students to it, but he says, I want to be sure. What do you teach limited atonement? Well, they asked Dr. Kuyper to prepare a statement, and he prepared a statement that was discussed on four or five Saturday mornings and then sent to the man, I think satisfied him. The thing that impressed me particularly in the statement was the emphasis that Kuyper put on the statement, a historic statement of belief, that the atonement is sufficient for everybody, but efficient only for the elect. Well, it seems to me that every Christian surely believes that. If he really believes in the Lord, he must believe the atonement is sufficient for everyone. On the other hand, of course, a person whom God has not chosen before the foundation of the world, certainly the atonement does not affect them. You have to be a believer for it. So that it didn't seem to me there was any reason to get really excited about it. But Kuyper came back after two or three years, and I should mention the second at the end, of the beginning of the second year, Robert Dick Wilson died, and of course that was a great loss to me because I'd been very intimate with him and with his family. But the loss was in a way made up for me by the fact that Dr. Kuyper, having left, they got a new instructor in theology whom I had known when we were both students at Princeton Seminary. That was John Murray, who had been a student there for 3 years, and during the next 7 years, he and I were together a very great deal. And I've never had a better fellowship in my life than I had with John Murray. After 1931, when I went back for the summer to Germany, he went the same summer. And we had a grand time over there during those years. And as I said, the first 3 years, it was partly the training and it was partly the background of the students that made them such a wonderful group.
Now, was Charlie Woodbridge associated with Westminster at that point,
no,
too?
No. Thank you for bringing me back to the... my mind gets on all these different areas. But Charlie became pastor of a church in Flushing, Long Island. And I went up there and preached for him and saw his growing family there. And occasionally he would get down, or occasionally I would get up, but we didn't have a great deal of contact during these first couple of years. And then Charlie went as a missionary to Africa. And he was over there, I guess, about 3 years. And when he came back from that, he was just filled with feeling about the way that modernism was coming into the mission field. And he told of a time when they had a great meeting and gathered people from their churches all over that area. And then some prominent speaker who had come from America spoke and just denied many of the fundamentals of the faith and how upset he was. And he saw the way modernism was encroaching in the mission field. Well, to lead up to what comes next, we have to see what Dr. Machen did. Dr. Machen was seeing the way things were developing, and he became concerned with the fact that some of our graduates had a very hard time with the Board of Foreign Missions. Would ask them. They wanted to be sure they would be obedient and wouldn't be striving with others. And the student would say, can you get on with modernists? Can you work with somebody you don't agree with? The mission board leader would say. The students would say, well, are there unbelievers among the missionaries? They would find some other way to get after them. And they were having difficulty. Well, that to Dr. Machen was important, but secondary. He was primarily interested in making a stand against modernism everywhere, and this called his attention to it on the mission field. And eventually, when two or three of the students had been turned down by the board, though several others were accepted, he thought of organizing an independent board for foreign missions. And I think he was about half interested in this for getting good, sound people to the mission field, but about half of it as a banner to raise in this country, because that's what he was greatly interested in, was opposing the modernism in this country, naturally. This is the center from which the missionary money all comes, and if it dies here, it'd be a terrible loss to the whole Christian cause. Well, now I might mention that right about that time, there was a friend of mine in Los Angeles, graduate of the same college I was, and graduate of Princeton Seminary, who had organized a work to work among the students in the University of California at Los Angeles. And he was there 3 or 4 years, and he got a number of groups of Bible classes organized. I think the time came when he had 30 different classes that were under his general supervision that he had organized, and he taught most of them. And he had a camp over in Catalina they used to go to every summer, where they would give them good, sound Christian teaching during that time, and he was having quite an influence there. And then the Presbytery of Los Angeles, of the old Presbyterian Church, to which we all belonged to in those days, the one from which I was ordained originally, they sent a young man whom we had both known in college, named Glenn Moore, to the university there and made him their representative for student work. And Milo greeted him cordially and introduced him to his students. And I think after a year or two, Glenn had one class of students that met once a year, and Milo had about 30. And then the presbytery said that Milo was interfering with the established Presbyterian life on the work on the campus, and called on him to discontinue his activity there because he was interfering with Glenn Moore's work, his 30 class interfering with Glenn's one. Well, they brought it up, and he and Sam Sutherland, another of our fellows from college and Princeton, were both dropped from the presbytery for their disobedience in continuing their work among students, interfering with the established Presbyterian work on the campus. Well, they were out of the church then. And each of them went on serving the Lord, but in an independent way. And Dr. Machen, hearing of it, was said, that is premature. He said, they should not have left the church. He said, they should stay in the church. Now, there's not sufficient reason to leave it. Well, Dr. Machen was busy founding this independent board. And when they got the independent board started, and he got people from prominent ministers and others to become members of the board, and they had sent out a couple of missionaries, the Presbyterian board got the impression that their millions of dollars they were going to lose, that they'll all go to this board. And so they began to bring charges against it and began to attack the board. Well, Dr. Alice was very much upset about this. And Dr. Alice said that when Dr. Machen had started the board, he told him, he said, I don't think you ought to confuse your work in the seminary by starting a work like this, he said. And I think that is unfortunate. And Dr. Alice said that it was none of his business, that as long as he taught his classes, what he did outside was up to him, between him and the Lord. And Dr. Alice had no right to question it or criticize it. Well, I don't know about that. But at any rate, there was a little disagreement between those two men who had worked so closely together before. Then Dr. Machen got a letter from Charlie telling about his experiences with modernism on the mission field, and Dr. Machen said, if we could get Charlie for the general secretary of the independent board, and he could go around the country speaking for it, think what a force it would be. And so they got in touch with Charlie and invited him to come. Well, now, in the presbytery, some of our associates there had been making some trouble for the modernists. We had, I think, 9 men who worked together who were in the presbytery. And though the presbytery was overwhelmingly evangelical, there were these 9 men who would always be bringing up points of order and standing against anything the rest of us stood for and so on. And they were, one fellow, Dr. Griffith, even brought charges against them when Dr. Alice was moderator. But they managed on a technicality to get the charges squashed. But there was strong feeling there in the presbytery. Then the rumor was around that a man was coming here from Africa to start a campaign against, on Dr. Machen's behalf, against the modernists. And so that day, when people came to enter the presbytery, the modernists began questioning them very closely. And there was one young missionary who wanted to join our presbytery, and he came that day, and the modernists questioned him down about his beliefs and why had he come and everything, and he didn't know what on earth they were talking about. And it really was funny to see the way they went after this poor fellow. They couldn't find anything that he said they could criticize. So he was received into the presbytery, and then the modernist leaders went out to have a smoke. And so they went outside and smoked, and while they were out there, Charlie Woodbridge was, the name was called. He went forward, and the moderator asked him a couple of questions, and he says, yes, and they received him into the presbytery. And this other fellow they'd been asking, was he going to cause trouble, and what was he going to do? Charlie wasn't asked anything, and somebody afterwards speaking, said, "My," he says, "that's a good argument against using tobacco." Dr. Stonehouse said, "No, it's an argument in favor of using tobacco." But anyway, Charlie came, and he and I had an occasional good visit. But I was working in the seminary, and he was out around the country raising money for the independent board, and so we did not see a great deal of each other during the next few years. But Dr. Machen pushed forward with this, and people of the board were very much afraid of what was going to happen. They were going to lose millions of dollars. And so they brought charges against these people and against the members of the independent board. And as soon as the word came out that they were bringing charges, the ministers of prominent churches all over the country who belonged to the independent board resigned from it. And Dr. Machen selected other people who were known for their loyalty to the cause of Christ to join the board in place of these who, a great many of them, resigned at that time. Then, when the attack came against the board, they asked, Dr. Machen asked that the members, he asked the board of the seminary, which included some prominent Presbyterian ministers and many outstanding Christians, he asked them to take a stand against the attack of the independent board. And he said, so we wanted them to tell us and tell the world what you think of this. And Dr. Alice said, here, you've gone ahead and started this and told us it's none of our business what you're going to do, and now you say we've all got to come to the defense of it, and we've got to maintain it. He said, that's not right. And so they asked the faculty to sign a statement asking the board to take a strong stand for the independent board. And as Dr. Machen said, tell us and tell the world where you stand about the independent board. Well, Dr. Alice did not like that. And John Murray thought it was not the right way to do things. And I didn't feel that it was quite the way to do it. So we three didn't sign the statement. And the other four, or five, I forget, which did sign it. And they read it to the board, and some on the board said, well, let's drop the ones that signed the statement and run a seminary with the others, which, of course, we were not interested in at all. And Dr. Machen came to us and asked the two of us to join, make a statement that we were not against the independent board or anything, that we just didn't quite like the way things were being done there. I forget what was an innocuous statement, which he and I signed, and Dr. Alice resigned from the seminary. And when Dr. Alice resigned, the majority of the members of the board resigned. Practically all the pastors of large churches resigned. And Dr. McCartney, who had been one of the close associated with Dr. Machen for years and years, and stood with him on everything before, he was now pastor of the big church in Pittsburgh, and he resigned when the rest did. The majority resigned, but before they resigned, they elected new men who were selected, most of them recent graduates, and filled up the board. And so the next year, Dr. Alice went away to Europe for a year, and Dr. Machen organized a group which he called the Presbyterian Constitutional Covenant Group, and they got a lot of fine Christian people to join this Presbyterian Constitutional Covenant Group. Now, during this time, there had gradually been a change coming in the character of the students and the attitude of the students. And whether this change was due to Dr. Kuyper's influence, who after being away 3 years came back and taught, or whether it was due to Dr. Van Til's attitude on apologetics and various other matters, or what all entered into it, I couldn't say. I remember Dr. Van Til saying, one of the students said to me one day, he says, nobody can be in this seminary more than 3 or 4 weeks without getting into a discussion of the limited atonement. And there had never been any such arguments the first 3 years when I was there. And there seemed to be an attitude developing among the students that our work was not to go out and preach the gospel and carry out the Lord's command to go into all the world and win converts to Christ, but that our objective was to attack the other Christians who differed with us on any one of a number of various points. And I got the impression sometimes there were people there who it seemed to me they could recognize an Arminian 2 blocks away, but a modernist could come right up to them and students, as a whole, were very hostile to him. They said this Presbyterian Constitutional Covenant Union, they've got people in there who are Arminians, they've got premillennialists in there, they've got people there who stand for prohibition and who oppose smoking, and they said Dr. Machen shouldn't be having fellowship with people like that. Dr. Machen said to me, he says, why do these students criticize me this way? He said, why don't they come into the Presbyterian Constitutional Union and stand up for the Reformed faith and speak for it there? But to criticize us who are trying to do something and take a stand against modernism. He said, it's terrible. But he was the most unpopular man in the school the next year. He realized it himself, and he spoke to me about it. Of course, he'd be in teaching his classes in a way, but he felt the attitude which developed among the students. And I was in a class I would give an argument from archaeology defending the scripture, and one of the students speak up and say, what are we bothering with all these historical arguments for? We've got the philosophic argument, what do we need all this for? And during those last 3 years I was there, I just gradually came to feel that my time was just being wasted. Instead of helping to train people to go out like the people that Dr. Machen got into the independent board and got into the board of the seminary and present the word of God, we were training people to think that all Christians, except those that hold our view on every little point, are just wicked, and to fight them instead of fighting the modernists. And I got more and more unhappy during that time. And then, of course, the next year, after the one I spoke of when Dr. Machen was so unpopular with most of the students, that next year, the big attack came against him. And of course, he stood up against the attack, and students now rallied around Dr. Machen as the one who was being attacked, and the attitude of the previous year toward him personally was largely forgotten. Another thing that Dr. Machen now, one thing that bothered me was Dr. Machen's attitude now was everybody should leave the Presbyterian Church at once because what they're doing to me and what they're doing to the independent board. Well, when they did to Milo Jameson just as bad, he said, that's premature. And it seemed to me that the way we were getting people into the fine churches, and they were getting an influence here and there, that if we could continue for 20 years that way, we could get control of the Presbyterian church. We could get rid of the moderates. But the great bulk of the church didn't realize the situation at all. I remember hearing of one fellow who was pastor of a big church and was called from it to become president of McCormick Seminary. And in his final message, this is about the time Westminster was started, he said to the people, he said, "When I came here, if I had talked to you like I do now, you would have thrown me out. But," he says, "I've been here 4 years," and he says, "you've come to see the absurdity of a lot of these old-fashioned ideas that you were holding when I came. And now you are at one with me," and everything, so on. Well, they were moving. But our men could have moved. We were getting a big influence here and there. And if only Dr. Machen could have been patient to keep on training with the wonderful training he was giving, they could eventually have taken over control, I believe. Dr. Alice said, "If there's a split over the independent, any split over the independent board will be a splinter." That's what Dr. Alice said. And of course, that's what it proved. Well, they were having meetings year after year at the General Assemblies. The independent board was being attacked. And Dr. Machen and McAllister Griffiths and some of the others were making a strong stand in the assemblies. And they were having these attacks against them. And now there's something I was leading up to right there and it slipped my mind. What was it? See, at 87,
memory doesn't work. About the purpose of their meetings at the General Assembly?
Yes, they were having the... Oh, yes. They were one of the... At the meeting, there was one of these ministers who Dr. Machen had invited to be member of the Independent Board. And who was actively working with them. He was pastor of a big Presbyterian church in town. And he mentioned at some time later how at the meeting, the assembly voted against the independent board, voted that it was against the laws of the church and everybody must leave the independent board or be tried and fired from the church. Well, this man went to a meeting with some of these fellows, some recent graduates who were having a meeting about what was ahead now. And he said, instead of being all feeling dissatisfied, unhappy about the losing everything, they were joyful. They said, "Now we can start a church that will be a true church, that will on all these points stand absolutely right," they said. And they went on to mentioning the things that they were going to stand against, many of which were things this man believed in and which Dr. Machen knew he believed in when he asked him to stand with them. And he was in these things, and now he felt as if after using him for a time, they were just throwing him away. And next year, when they tried Dr. Machen and unfrocked him, as they called it, and did the same with all the others, of course, that were in the independent board, then they started a new church, and it was, Dr. Machen was enthused about it. He was the first moderator, and they had a lot of wonderful people in it. But the control was in the hands of people that had just graduated. They just ordained 20 people in the church. And they were in the control of it. And I remember at the end of Dr. Machen's term as moderator, he wanted Dr. Buswell to be moderator. And the others, they didn't like Dr. Buswell. He was for prohibition. He was a premillennialist. Dr. Buswell had sent more students than the other three people put together to the seminary. He had been greatly praised by all through the years, but he did not take the view on all these secondary points necessarily. He was very close to their view, actually. There wasn't much difference that I could see. But there were some who just couldn't stomach the idea of having Dr. Buswell as the moderator. Well, Dr. Machen died suddenly, has a He was a martyr to his desire to build up this new fine church. He went up to North Dakota, and there were three churches, maybe 15 people in each, 50 miles apart, and he rode through the freezing weather, and he began to get pains, and he wouldn't miss an appointment. He was absolutely loyal to his appointments, and he stuck to it. And in the end, pneumonia got so bad that he died up there, of course, on January 1st, 1937. And then after that, then they were determined the new church would be absolutely right. And some of the ministers in it, they were insisting on they must use fermented wine. And most of the people that came had been prohibitionists for years. And to use fermented wine in communion, they didn't want that. And then some of the fellows said, we must only sing psalms, no more hymns, no more secular hymns. And people were used to those lovely old hymns, and they didn't like that, and they just began starting going on matters like this, and the church, it worked out as Dr. Ellis said. The new church they started was only Dr. Ellis say, and he split, will be a splinter. It was only a splinter, and it was very disappointing. And I reached the point where I just could not stay with it any longer, and I resigned. Well, now Charlie Woodbridge, which was our main topic, I mustn't get away from him. Charlie was secretary of the Independent Board, writing to missionaries and going about the country, raising money for it, and active in all these meetings in the church and the assembly and all that. And Charlie, for heard that I had resigned from the board, and they told him McRae was disloyal, he was not with the movement, and Charlie simply decided to do everything he could to get people to support the work Dr. Machen had founded and to support the stand with the new church. He said the Southern Church is just as bad as the Northern Church. He said they haven't gone quite as far, but they're just as bad. And they had a meeting of the Independent Board at which there was a rumor that one of the missionaries, there were four missionaries to be sent to India, and this one, a very fine chap, there was a rumor that he had, that he drank alcoholic liquors. And Dr. Stamm raised the question. He said, I would like to know, is he going out to India and going to use alcoholic liquors and make raise confusion among the new Christians with the stand against drunkenness we want to take? And they asked him, and this fellow was very, very gracious fellow. He says, I don't see any harm in drinking a little bit of light wine occasionally, he said. But he said, out of respect for the board, out of respect for Dr. Stamm, out of respect for the rest of you, he says, I will gladly promise that I will never partake of such things again. Well, there were three others who were with the same group, and Dr. Stamm said, well, we've heard from Mr. Whitaker. I'd like to hear from the other folks. So they asked the other three fellows who came from families, strong prohibitionist families, very earnest Christians, and they asked all three of them, and they refused to give any promise that they would not personally use alcoholic beverages. Refused to, and got excited about it. And the result was that they decided to question. They were supposed to leave for India. Very soon they decided that the board decided they should be further examined. And then all the people in the board resigned, the people from the board, members who were closely associated with the faculty then resigned from the board. And Charlie, as I say, Charlie was They asked me, the board asked me to go into the board for 2 months at halftime to try to organize the work. Charlie resigned from the board. And he resigned on 3 months' notice. 3 months, gave 3 months' notice. Well, he was propagandizing against the board then. And so they accepted it immediately, and they asked me to go into the office for 2 months at halftime. Well, I was in there 4 months at full time. And I found that during the previous 2 months, or about since I'd resigned from the seminary, Charlie had been, you get letters from the missionaries, what should we do about this? And he'd write back, I haven't time to answer your questions now, I'll answer them fully next month. But then he would go along propagandizing them. And he was going about traveling, meeting people, you know. And he was loyal to Dr. Machen. He'd been associated with Dr. Machen closely, but he hadn't been associated much with the members of the faculty or with the newer students who were taking over the leadership in the new church. And so he felt they were under attack, and he wanted to do what he could. He was right with them. He took a strong stand there that way. And so he left the board, and I forget, I think he was given some position. I know he became editor of the Presbyterian Guardian, the new paper they started about 7 years before. And of course, I had to try to write the missionaries to explain what had happened, and I saw that was the great need, and I put my attention to that. And meantime, letters from donors that should have been answered hadn't been for a couple of weeks, and the secretary thought I should be taking care of that. And I felt that the correspondence to tell what had happened was the most important thing right then. And we had a prayer meeting, and the secretary said, God, help poor Dr. McCrae. He doesn't know where to begin. But, of course, I was doing what was necessary, getting the next bulletin ready. And then we heard Charlie became editor of the paper. And then we got the Presbyterian Guardian came. And in this, he told about the Westminster graduates, how they were out standing on street corners preaching the gospel, reaching people for the Lord. Oh, the picture he gave, which sounded so different from the attitude of those men then had. It just didn't fit them all. And I read it. I said, Charlie certainly hasn't had much contact with the way things have been developing, and he's got an ideal, and he's imagining his ideal is the way it is. And I read these things, and I think when Charlie got in, I don't know, I did not have a talk with him, but it just seems to me that as he got to talk with these leaders and saw what their attitude was toward the Christian leaders that might differ on some tiny point with them, or that worse, that were premillennialists, or that stood, oh, by the way, on premillennialism, I was with John Murray and another fellow, and they were talking about how the terrible board, the independent board, was. It's got lots of premillennialists in, and it's got a lot of dispensationalists in. Well, they went through the list of the board, and this fellow's a premillennialist, this fellow's a dispensationalist, at least three-fourths of the board were one or the other. And the only difference I could see between what they thought was a dispensationalist and what they thought was a premillennialist was that if one thought it was important enough to stand for it rather than just something to mention, he was a dispensationalist. Otherwise, he's merely a premillennialist. Well, I think that this is purely guess now, because I didn't have another talk with Charlie then. But I just can't help thinking that Charlie, getting with them and hearing the way they talked about the other people in the independent board and about all those who differed on any tiny point, he just saw that what he was getting into wasn't a continuation of the Presbyterian Church with a strong stand for the gospel that the Presbyterian Church had always held, as people have held, but something that's going to fight over all these little minor issues and everything. And I think he just got to feeling the way I had felt when I found it necessary to leave. And so, at any rate, the next we heard, Charlie had gone to the South, accepted a call to a Southern Presbyterian church, and the people there said, or they raised questions, isn't he connected with that independent ward outfit that's making trouble in the Northern church? And according to what I heard, Charlie told them, my father's ancestors were Presbyterian ministers, my mother's ancestors were prominent in the church. We have a tradition going way back. We've been North Carolinians so long, and so the presbytery elected him, and he was there, and of course he just disappeared. Many people wondered what became of Charlie. Well, I didn't see him again until I got a letter from Ockengay, who was pastor of the big church in Boston. And Ockengay said, we want to start a new seminary. And he says, we're going to start it in California. Fuller's providing the money for it. He said, it's going to be premillennial, not dispensational. And he said, if Everett Harrison, Alan McRae, Charlie Woodbridge, and Carl Henry will come, we'll start it next year. If one of them won't come, we will start it the year after next. And he said, we want to meet in Chicago to discuss the plans. And I had persuaded the board of Faith Seminary to give me money to go abroad to get books right after the war. It was the best plan to get books to build up the library, and I'd had a little difficulty persuading them, but they had agreed to give me the money and pay my expenses to do it. And I wrote back to Ockengay, and I simply said, I have made this arrangement for this summer for the seminary. I couldn't consider making any change at this time. And that's what I wrote him, and I went to Europe. And then they spread the rumor that I was coming, and my friends here heard it, and it was considerable excitement, but that's getting on up another thing. Then I got a letter from Charlie a little after that, and he said, well, know what I was going to do, he says he was digging in the South. Well, then, a little later, Charlie decided he would go for it anyway, so he went, and he taught there, and he was dean of students for a while, and a friend of mine who visited him heard that he was going. He was, every weekend, I think he was spending 3 nights on the sleeper. Of course, we didn't have planes then. And he would fly Los Angeles to another place, and he'd have a big meeting and give a Bible study, and then he'd go to another place, and he went to about 6 or 7 places, and he was making as much money from those meetings as he was from the teaching. And of course, they claimed they were giving, Fuller was paying more than any other school in the country, they claimed at that time. But he was getting along flying there, but then things went bad at Fuller, and Charlie got disgusted and left. And he said what he thought about it, told what he thought about Fuller, and I think he was a bit frustrated by his experience there. I think that affected him. I only saw him occasionally after that, but he had the most charisma just about anybody I ever heard. A friend of mine was at Camp in the Woods. You know where who's this man up there that has, I can't think of his name. He's at the lake. It's the lake.
Worson?
Yes, Worson, at this lake. He was going every summer after he left there and speaking there. And this friend of mine was there, his minister. And Charlie said to him, he says, if you can't think of what to say and you're given a term, something, your mind leaves, you can't think, just go on talking. Just go on talking and it'll come back to you. He said, how can you talk and not say anything? He says, well, he says, I'll show you. He says, you watch. And he says, the two of them he'd been talking to, he says, Charlie was given the address, everybody was just on the edge of their seat. And he said, all of a sudden they realized he hasn't said anything for 5 minutes, and yet everybody's just as thrilled as they were before. Charlie had the personality, and he was a force if he could be under the direction of somebody like Dr. Machen. He was a tremendous force. But most people that have that ability I've sometimes thought that people that easily influence others are often the most easily influenced themselves. And it's a colorful part of my experience in life with my contacts with Charlie. Well, thank you very much,
Dr. McCray. Maybe we could take a few moments for questions or anything.
Well, do you have any questions?
Do you have
Is there anything I didn't make clear?
I don't have any specific questions, but it was all exceedingly interesting, Anna.
I'm a little unclear on Charlie leaving the independent board. Why did he leave as secretary again after promoting the board?
I never had an opportunity to talk to him about it. And it's only as I've thought about it, particularly recently as I thought about it and remembered, the way the impression he gave as editor of the paper was of just the sort of thing that he and I were interested in when Westminster was started, but it was utterly foreign to the way it was then.
Well, how did that relate to the board, though? He was secretary. Why didn't he answer those missionaries' letters?
Well, he was writing them.
Why was he putting them off? He was
propagandizing against me and against the people who had left Westminster then and left the new church. He was propagandizing, going around seeing them, trying to argue with people that had influence.
So he kind of somewhat shifted from his fundraising for the board and promotion of the board to other agendas.
Yes. During those two or three months before he left the board. Yes. And I think he was seeing everything through Dr. Machen's eyes. And he was devoted to Dr. Machen, devoted to the ideal Dr. Machen had. And then this is guess on my part, but my guess is he threw himself into it, into writing and working and editing a paper in the influence for the new church. And then as he talked with people, he got to know the things that I had been contact with that had forced me to leave.
Now,
that's my guess, because he, in the situation, he, I think, reached the point where he just kind of gave up and went back on everything he'd been supposedly standing for before. And incidentally there, it's sad to think how Ed Ryan, who was Charlie's closest friend, Ed was what was his position in Westminster? He was almost leader of things.
Secretary.
And he was strong in this whole business, and he wrote this book on the Presbyterian conflict and so on. And then, eventually, he got into disagreements, and he went back to the old church, and they reordained him.
Now,
he confessed his sin and was reordained, and eventually was assistant to the president of Princeton Seminary.
Were you ever disciplined by the church, or was Charlie Woodbridge, when he took that church in North Carolina or wherever, did he still have his Northern Church ordination?
I don't know. I don't remember hearing about a trial for him.
So it could have been just a transfer for him.
I don't know.
How about yourself? What happened with your ordination from Los Angeles Presbytery years before?
I transferred it when I began teaching.
To Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
And then what happened?
And when it came in the end, after Dr. Machen was thrown out, somebody wrote a paper, which several of us signed, that in view of the way that the church had gone, we were leaving it.
So you resigned. There was never any trial.
Yes, I got a letter. I was out in Los Angeles with my family, and I got a notice to appear for trial. Then I got another notice that I hadn't tried. Another notice that I had in absentia been convicted and dropped.
Really?
Yeah, yes.
By the Presbytery of Philadelphia?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Why would they do that, although there were only 9 liberals?
Well, there were nine out-and-out liberals, and the bulk of the people wanted to stand for the truth, but they were kind of easygoing and didn't really take a big stand, and they didn't know much about the independent board, and they did know that some of the folks were making trouble for the leaders and the presbytery and so on. They didn't know much about it.
Now, when that happened, did you... Your ordination credentials were then entered in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church?
Well, Dr. Machen called it the Presbyterian Church of America. And, of course, they entered the credentials and called us ministers in the church and so on. And then as they began taking this stand on alcohol and everything, I was still in that church when they had an assembly, and somebody presented the mildest resolution against alcohol, and they voted it down. They would not take any stands. You know. They were just determined, you've got to be exactly like us. And I personally was not terribly excited on the particular points. Now, I didn't like it on premillennialism that they were telling people outside that we don't take any stand. Pre, post, off, we don't take any stand. And we got Dr. McCrae's a premillennialist. We got Paul Woolley's a premillennialist. Well, Paul was a premillennialist to the end of his life, I believe. But I never heard of him saying anything about it in his classes or anything. And I never said much about it. I found out in those last 3 years that other faculty members were just tearing into it, where the students were, many of them, just terribly excited about how terrible premillennialism was. My attitude, although I am definitely with premillennialism, was like Dr. Wilson used to say. Dr. Wilson says, I'm not a premillennialist, I'm not a postmillennialist, I'm not an amillennialist, I'm a millennialist. which doesn't make much sense by itself, but what it means is that he was standing for whatever's clear in the scripture and not making a fight over secondary points. But the thing that irritated me was that people were being told to give money because they weren't against premillennialism. I was a premillennialist, and yet students were being turned quietly in classes into hating premillennialism. That's the thing I didn't like. I felt I was being used, misrepresented.
Just one more comment. I understand Charlie Woodbridge today doesn't have anything to do with just about anybody. Do you know what led to that rather sad end in his case, as opposed to yourself, who has remained flexible and broadened despite these difficulties?
Charlie had some big disappointments, you see, I think. He got into that. He was editor of the paper. He was going to make a big stand and for the kind of church he believed in. Then I think he found out what I found earlier, that it wasn't the kind of church he believed in. And I think he was so disappointed after working so that he just says, oh, forget it all. And he went down there and says, I'll preach the gospel and I'll win souls to the Lord. And while he was down there, he worked at the university and got a PhD in history and everything. And then he was invited to this seminary that was going to stand for the truth and got out there, and then they went bad. And I think he just got so...
Do you know why he left Carl McIntyre's work?
No. He was, he was born against. He was strongly for Carl, then he was against him. I don't know. I didn't see much of it in those years. But I can see the disappointment of a man who thought he was going to build a big church for the truth, and then it just wasn't what he figured on. I can see his disappointment. And then he went to Fuller, that Hockengate called me next Christmas and talked for half an hour on the phone from Boston, urging me to come. And, of course, the way what the plans were for Fuller, I've sometimes thought, would Fuller have been kept true if I'd gone? I don't think I'd have had that much influence. I don't think I would have. But what can't help thinking, Carl Henry told me he's wondered if I'd gone where they could have been kept true. He made a fight and finally he had to leave, of course. Yeah?
Do you attribute Woodbridge's disappointment to some short-sightedness on his part?
Well, maybe. I was more the student, and I could stand aside and look at things while the man was in the middle of the fray. Like he and Dr. Machen, you're apt to, in the middle of things, things look big that are close to you, and you don't take the time to go through it.
That's right.
But the great disappointment to me, if only Westminster had been like it was the first 3 years, had continued that way, or even with the way it had gone, if Dr. Machen hadn't started the independent board, maybe start one 20 years later if he wanted, but if he let them get people into the churches. And of course the modernists were figuring, how can we prevent them getting into our churches? How can we do it? And when the independent board was formed, it gave the modernists something to talk about. And of course then it made Dr. Machen's attitude was, Milo was wrong to leave the church, though they treated him that way. But when they've done this to the independent board, now everybody should realize the church is apostate and get out. And of course most people didn't even know about it. They hadn't even heard of it. And of the graduates in previous years, very few joined the new church. But from the last year or two, there were, I guess, 40 or 50 joined the new church, and they were men of real ability. But they were going to, I remember hearing Joe Young I heard a sermon by him in which he talked about the enemies outside the church and the enemies inside the church. And there were premillennialists and Arminians and dispensationalists, and he went down and named all the enemies in the church. You know, they were more interested in that than they were in the stand for the gospel. It was sad, because Joe was a wonderful fellow, Joe Young. I liked him very much. In fact, I liked all the people there. I liked Kuyper, so I think he was a bad influence on the whole. Van Til and I kept a friendship right to the end. He used to come up here and visit occasionally. I went down and visited him occasionally. And I like these people. It's a pleasure to reminisce about them. But it's sad to think of the way the thing they tried to start didn't work the way they come.
Were you hit hard by Machen's death?
Oh, of course. Of course, how could I help him? That previous summer, he and I had climbed together in the Canadian Rockies, and we were very close. And it came so suddenly. And he was a martyr to the cause of starting a new church. But unfortunately, as Dr. Alice says, it was only a sliver. And of course, the Presbyterian Church, the PCA, I think is pretty near what Dr. Machen wanted. No, but it had to come from a new separate article.
Yes? McCray, when Machen was seeking to defend the independent board and getting the seminary to back him, why did the seminary board end up resigning?
Well, as somebody said, it was the way he did it, I think. See, they weren't in close touch. They'd come to the meetings, and they were at the meeting, and it was none of their business what he was doing. See, outside. And then they are told, tell us and tell the world where you stand on this. And some of them were disgusted at the way it was done. In fact, Murray and Alice and I, of course, didn't go along with it that way in the first place.
It just seems rather drastic that everyone
resigned. But didn't they have to? I mean, these were rather prominent people who stayed in the Northern Church, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So they were kind of on the edge at that point.
Well, no.
Before
that, they had all the... a third of the board had previously resigned because of the charges, the attack. And they had elected young fellows in their place, of these third. You're speaking of the independent board.
I was speaking more of the seminary
the
board.
The seminary...
Didn't those board members, at some point, it was clear to them that they had to take a certain stand or they couldn't stay on the seminary board? Or was that the independent board?
Well... it was the seminary board, yes. The independent board they had left 2 years before. About half, two-thirds had left. But not two-thirds of the independent board. But of the seminary board, I think it was 60% that resigned.
By choice, though.
They resigned because they were told you must support the independent board. And that's why they did.
Then they hadn't conceded to liberalism so much.
Oh my, not at all. And in fact, some of the graduates who refused to join the new church, who were already in churches, have died recently. I've read their epitaphs. I mean, and they have, some of them have made a real stand in the Presbyterian Church. They haven't made the kind of stand that would get them fired, but they've made a stand that has trained people and has given a real witness in the church. Some of, quite a few of the previous graduates have, that never left the church. And if only Dr. Machen could have been patient, you see, I think they could have taken over the church. Or if they didn't, they could have let out, instead of a few hundred, they could have let out 40% of the list. But it's sad. In my sources in church history, I used to sometimes talk about, say there's the providence of God, but there's also the providence of the devil. And we see instances both. Like in Poland, Christianity got such a start in Poland, the Protestant movement, Lutheranism, or Calvinism was in Poland. It got such a start in Poland that when they got a new king, he had to swear he would not do anything against the Reformed faith, the king of Poland. And then the Jesuits came in. And people, the leaders of the Reformers there, they were strong for the Reformed faith, and the Lutherans in Germany didn't help them any because they weren't Lutheran. And the Jesuits worked, starting with arguments and then with organizing mobs and riots, and in the end, they practically did away with Protestantism in Poland. It's the province of the devil is real in our age. And I think we just have to keep our eyes on the Lord and try to do the best we can to serve Him wherever He places us. And realize that you can't depend on the best of human beings. They make mistakes, and they may be led astray, but we put our trust in the Lord and follow Him. People will misunderstand us and misrepresent us, but what matters is what the Lord thinks of us. That's all that matters. And Charlie, 5 years ago, my wife and I were in California, and we drove down from San Francisco. And one morning, Sunday morning, we left a little town on the seacoast, and we drove inland. And at church time, we drove our car off to the side, off the road, and we read the book of Zechariah through there. And then we went on, and I stayed with a friend in Santa Paula that night, and I mentioned Charlie Woodbridge to him. And he says, Charlie is living in a town just 10 miles from where we'd stopped then. And he's preaching every Sunday at a little church there. And oh, if I'd only known it, I'd so love to hear it. So love to hear it. He's one of the most able speakers I ever heard in my life. As I said, he could talk of nothing. A lot of people think it's wonderful. I heard him in Berlin when the nationalists took Nanking, and according to the papers in this country, you didn't know what was going to happen. And they asked Charlie to speak in the American church, and they had a crowd there. And he talked for 5 minutes on how he wished he could give you a real understanding of this. He wished he had time to really explain it. And then the next 5 minutes was how he wished he could really give you an understanding of Chinese conditions. But he has so little time, he's promised not to go over 20 minutes, and then the next 5 minutes was similar. The last 5 minutes, he gave some good stuff about China. But the people, when he finished, the most wonderful talk I ever heard on China. Oh, he just explained everything. It was so wonderful. I could not laugh.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. McRae.
Well, thoughts flood back when you think of those days. It's hard to sort of out, you know. One thing suggests another.
Well, I think you did a wonderful job of sorting them out, very organized.
Well, we covered a lot of ground.
We did. We covered a tremendous amount.